Our next speaker is very well known in New York. She comes from the Center for Work Education at CUNY, City University of New York, Sister Professor Barbara Omolade.
First of all, good afternoon. I'd like to dedicate my remarks to my son, Kip Omolade, also known as Case, who is a rapper and an artist, who will be 22 next week, and he is, for me, the best well-read on Malcolm X, and one of the most learned people on Malcolm X's life, and also helped me do research for my presentation. In August of 1964, Fannie Lou Hamer, a black sharecropper and civil rights activist, leading a delegation of black people from Mississippi, attempting to tell her story of struggle to vote to the Credential Committee approving state delegates to the Democratic Party Presidential Convention. Her briefly televised testimony was rudely interrupted by the then president and leading candidate, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Ms. Hamer and her group protested, went home, where she continued to struggle in relative obscurity and died several years later. Nearly 30 years later, Anita Hill, another black woman, law professor, told her story of sexual harassment to a Senate committee sitting to decide whether Judge Clarence Thomas should sit on the Supreme Court. Anita Hill's voice, story, and face became national news and a media event along with the man she accused of harassing her. The two public testimonies by these women, these black women, tell us a great deal about African-American politics and the nation it is situated in. One woman represented a movement, the other herself, although her story of harassment is a common one to most black women. Ms. Hamer spoke about the racial injustice all black people suffered, while Anita Hill's story reflected the contradictions and centrality of gender within the African-American psychic and politic today. Gender, however, unlike race, has a more tentative and less developed tradition within African-American political thought. Gender issues, however, continue to permeate tradition within African-American political thought. Gender issues, however, continue to permeate the quality of everyday life for nearly every black man and woman. While condemning white male abuse of black women was a continuing theme of our anti-slavery, anti-segregation, and anti-racist efforts, the experiences of black female abuse by black men has remained a silenced and unspoken reality, even with the valiant efforts of many black women such as Sojourner Truth, Frances Harper, Ida Wells, and the like. And they struggle very hard, especially women like Ida Wells, to put on the black African-American political agenda the condition and position of black women. In those days, however, the African-American community had a prevailing unity, as Bill Strickland has described it, which enabled black men and women to work together, not without conflict and chauvinism, but with at least the countervailing force of harmony and mutual respect. By the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, that unity had been ripped away and ripped asunder by both our movement to end racial segregation and the white conservative responses to it. Rape of black women has become one of the most frequent black-on-black crimes in the country. African-American women between the ages of 16 to 24 were three times as likely to be raped as white women. The murder of and battering of black women and children by black men has become a daily occurrence. Black women were more likely to be assaulted by boyfriends and separated or divorced women were 14 times more likely to and children by black men has become a daily occurrence. Black women were more likely to be assaulted by boyfriends and separated or divorced women were 14 times more likely to be assaulted by a spouse or ex-spouse. Young black men, many of them out of control, are so out of control that the terms hoe and bitch have become a regular way of describing black women, as the black intelligentsia continue to quibble and grandstand over books and movies such as The Color Purple and act out their gender wars on national television for their own self-interest. There have been scores of black forums, debates, and conferences, and many of them devoted to either black women or black men or the relationship between them. And the personal stories, and I think this is real critical, if you talk to people about their personal lives, there have been, every story, there's been stories of and tales of nightmares, of victories, of visions, but a lot of these sentences is real critical. If you talk to people about their personal lives, there have been, every story, there's been stories of tales of nightmares, of victories, of visions, but a lot of these center around sexuality, parenting, love, and unfortunately, abuse. Yet we only have a very limited analysis and theory about gender, and there's virtually no kind of active use of race and gender in terms of our body politic and our praxis. And I believe very strongly that it has been sexism more than any other force which has destroyed every organization, every initiative undertaken by African Americans, whether they are nationalists, socialists, or whatever. The negative behaviors of both black men and black women in many instances have been the biggest deterrent to building a strong movement, strong enough to protect our people as well as change the system. I want to describe what I call the race-gender system quickly, and I think it's necessary to get this background in order to really understand Clarence Thomas and Malcolm. The race-gender system works on several simultaneous levels, personal and social psychological, where it governs all our interpersonal relations, socializes and shapes appropriate role behavior. It is organized and works on the government, on the societal level, where it governs and shapes the content, context, and parameters of all our social institutions, family, school, and our social processes. It defines and shapes the public space and the public discourse, the political and economic and class stratification which governs our society. And even if we don't mention the word sexism or race or gender, they still act to divide and to cause much confusion within our own personal and political practices. One of the aspects of the race-gender system is the social reproduction of womanhood and manhood. Another are the systems of male violence against women. And another is the sexual code. And all three of them, as you probably well know now, are operative in the discussion around Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. What I feel very strongly about that is important to understand, and that is the social reproduction of gender is critical to our understanding of every society, including African American society. How do we become men and how do we become women? In fact, that is the reason that societies are created. And one of the things that societies do is they create the standards and practices to make males men and females women. Now, African Americans, of course, do not have the control over land production and power in addition to social reproduction that many other societies have. However, black parents and communities leaders have always struggled with white authority for control over their children's lives. And in essence, that fight for control over our children's education has been an aspect of social reproduction. Fostering, for example, the education of black girls in the 19th century was a means of keeping them away from white sexual abuse and to establish a different definition of black womanhood than that of white womanhood or the debased definition that white men had for us. And that is a tradition of pride and self-sufficiency and accomplishment. And black struggle, both Clarence Thomas and Malcolm X are a result of two different forms of social reproduction. Malcolm's story is familiar. He was orphaned at an early age because his father was murdered and his mother was institutionalized. He became grown living by his wits, like many black male adolescents, from the values and experiences of the streets. He became a pseudo-man. His transformation and rebirth in prison and his work as Minister Malcolm X represents a telling example of black control over gender reproduction. For the nation under the Honorable Elijah Muhammad taught Malcolm to become a man. It gave him discipline, integrity, and a vehicle for self-development and expression, no matter how we see the shortcomings of the nation on the woman question or other issues. And although this black nation was small and a small and limited community, it made Malcolm a very different kind of black man. He was bright and intelligent, but it was the combination of his intelligence, along with his experiences within this self-contained community, which developed his manhood, as well as other forces, which we'll talk about in a minute. Clarence Thomas's journey toward manhood began in a rural black community in the South. His father, as most also know, also died when he was a young boy. The family was divided. The boys went with the grandparents and the girls with their mother. Thomas, also bright and intelligent, was sent to an all-white private Catholic boys' high school and then went to elite colleges, and as a result of his relationship with Republicans and conservatives, became a prominent lawyer in EEOC and a judge. In short, Thomas's manhood was shaped and created by white men and white institutions. Thomas accepted and adapted the basic philosophy and values of the white ruling class who educated him. and as such he presents a very dangerous tendency for our people. For Malcolm and the men of his generation before him, men like my father and grandfather, the black community made a manhood, while the white community sought to destroy and break it. For most of our people, this is the prevailing pattern even today. But for gifted black children, as defined by black parents after 1954, the process also has a different direction. We were sent from black world into white world by our parents to be educated. They never thought we would be anything but black, and that our identity would remain black, that our blackness and our commitment to a black agenda was irreducible, erasable truth. Our mandate was to do our best, represent our race, and make a contribution to our people. We were expected to be race men and race women and come back and help those who were less privileged. But the process of socialization and education in white world was a brutal and competitive and direct opposition to black aesthetics, value systems, and culture. Many limped back to their families and communities as if from a war, broken and too numb to speak of the subtle and daily horrors they had experienced with racism in the white academy. Others function, but still don't have a way of understanding the intent of education in white institutions is in fact both to destroy the black mind and in fact and recreate a kind of white black person. In order to truly understand the experiences of the political content of Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill and the rest, it's necessary to have an international perspective. Because along with the brutality of colonial European conquest of people of color came an enlightened process whereby local elites would be trained by the colonial powers to run the countries and go back and control their people. And in France, in fact, most of these local elites were identified and selected within special schools in their colonies. After a weeding out process, the most intellectually bright but critically naive and impressionable were sent to the mother country to be further educated and then to return home to become their leaders. Black faces with white masks. However, the process backfired somewhat because men like Nkrumah, Fanon, Cabral, that through that process of leaving their particular colonies, they were able to learn about white power and to adapt skills and a political perspective to return to the source and lead national liberation struggles. This is precisely what happened to those of us who were the first large-scale numbers of black college students in white colleges. Not only did we become politicized and oppose white domination, but the very movement that made it possible for us to enter white colleges also taught us social responsibility. However, it was Malcolm X, more than anyone, who taught us how to use our intellectual abilities to critique, dissect, and deconstruct white power, to use language and rhetoric as a form of rebellion and resistance, to enter and see, white world through self-conscious, unashamed, nationalist lenses. Malcolm the man became for us the paradigm and example of how to be and how to conduct ourselves in white world. He broke with the tradition of muted voice and silence in the white man's presence. The nation empowered Malcolm to speak out like a man and look white men in the eye. We, the children of Malcolm, became even ever bit as militant, bold, and analytical, whether we became Marxist, feminist, or nationalist. But as the movement waned and became conservatism rose, more educated blacks endured the painful process of education in white academy without a movement. The conservative era has trounced the goals, the anti-racist goals of the movements and turned them on their head, so that now we have a large strata of black conservatives and perhaps an oxymoron is to call them black and conservative, a new stratum that not merely Uncle Tom's, but as Bill Sayles has said, they represent real power and a real position of power in the ruling elites. Nevertheless, even though black people may be very clear about that history, most black people via polls and on the street, men and women, supported Clarence Thomas. And though many believed Anita Hill's charges of sexual harassment were true, few thought them serious enough to stop his nomination. Most felt Anita Hill should have not revealed them in public on national TV or to a group of 14 white males. One black woman in a supermarket don't know what a black woman rape victim looks like. We don't know what sexual harassment of black women really is. 19th century slave owners boldly declared that black women could not be raped because we were presumed to be sexual animals. Our foremothers and mothers bore terrible burdens because many were raped by both white men and black men, but nevertheless continued to work in the fields, kitchens, and even bore the children of those brutal assaults. Today, thousands of black women have been raped, brutalized, and continue to work and function and remain silent. The Black Women's Health Project speaks of that silence as killing us, because since no one believes their story of abuse, they remain quiet. We all were taught to never betray a black man to a white man, never to condemn, and we were condemned for calling the police on black men who were beating and abusing us. Black men have played on our sympathy, Black men have played on our sympathy, our loyalty, and our silence to avoid being punished for their crimes. Clarence Thomas also played on this. This was his trump card. He knew black people would support him precisely because of our racial solidarity and our gender silence. Because his sexual harassment was verbal and not physical and occurred 10 years ago, and Anita Hill remained his loyal, sympathetic, and silent friend, her charges were not taken that seriously by many. As Rosemarie Bray indicated in her New York Times article and reminded us of Linda Brent, a slave woman who was sexually abused, badgering, innuendo, and sexual explicitness are more than nuisances and annoyances. They're brutal attempts to control women and black people, especially black women, in the public space by sexualizing that public space. Black women and girls can't walk down the streets of our communities today, irrespective of what they wear or how they wear it, without being humiliated by references to their body parts and sexual organs by black men. And worse, without being touched and groped by men like Mike Tyson. The alienation of this era, where black men are constantly harassed, attacked, and besieged themselves, and there is no political consciousness and movement, along with the spiral economic dislocation, which explains to black men, but does not, this doesn't excuse black men, the pornographic efforts they have to sexualize public space, and a vain and perverted effort to be men. Clarence Thomas and white men like them thrive on their pseudo-potential to control women, power to control women with sex. Thomas had the added advantage of being the boss, and like many cases of sexual harassment, he controlled women's economic interests as well. And I want to go back to Malcolm as I wind up, and that is because Malcolm X, interestingly enough, and people may forget it, and I want to take the time to go through and understand this, that Malcolm separated from the Nation of Islam because of his public disclosure of an act of sexual abuse of black women by Elijah Muhammad. 295 on the autobiography of Malcolm X, adultery. Malcolm says, why any Muslim guilty of adultery was summarily ousted in disgrace. One of the nation's most closely kept scandals was that a succession of the personal secretaries of Mr. Muhammad had become pregnant. They were brought before Muslim courts and they were charged with adultery and they confessed. Humiliated before the general body, they received sentences of from 1 to 5 years of isolation. That meant they were to have no contact whatsoever with any other Muslims. In Los Angeles, July 3rd, Elijah Muhammad, 67-year-old leader of the black Muslim movement, today faced paternity suits from two former secretaries who charged he fathered their four children. Both women are in their 20s. From 1957 until this year, they had intimacies with Elijah Muhammad. One alleged he fathered her two children and said she was expecting a third child by him. The other plaintiff said he was the father of her daughter. Malcolm says, next, I broke the rule that no Muslim is supposed to have any contact with another Muslim in an isolated state. I looked up and talked with three of the four former secretaries to Mr. Muhammad. From their own mouths, I heard their stories of who had fathered their children. And from their own mouths, I heard that Elijah Muhammad had told them I was the best and greatest minister he ever had, but someday I would leave him and turn against him, so I was dangerous. Loyal Muslims could be taught that a man's accomplishments in his life outweighed his personal human weaknesses, because Malcolm wanted Elijah to publicly confess to this weakness, to what he did. Elijah Muhammad, page 299. I'm David, he said. When you read about how David took another man's wife, I am that David. You read about Noah who got drunk? That's me. You read about Lot who went and laid up with his own daughters? I have to fulfill all those things, end quote. And Malcolm, in what began to break my faith, as he says on page 306, try as I might, I couldn't hide, I couldn't evade that Mr. Muhammad, instead of facing what he had done before his followers as a human weakness or as a fulfillment of prophecy, which I sincerely believe that Muslims would have understood, or at least they would have accepted. See, Malcolm thought if he stood up and said it, the Muslims would have understood. Mr. Muhammad had instead been willing to hide, to cover up what he had done. And of course, Malcolm was publicly censured and eventually separated from the nation. I want to close with saying this, that Malcolm's manhood was also shaped very critically by his formal relationship to traditional Islam and his Hajj to Mecca, where he became a part of a non-Western international religious movement. His crisis and connection with the newly emerging African nation cemented a third aspect of his socialization. He became a revolutionary nationalist with a pan-African focus and an international vision. His willingness to change direction and learn in a public and conscious way furthered much of his manhood. His relationship with his wife Betty and his sister Ella, his daughters, families, and friends have always revealed his personal generosity and honesty. His plea with Elijah Muhammad is instructional, and this is lessons for all of us, especially black men, and part of this man's grandeur. Tell the truth. Admit your weaknesses. He did so and was so able to claim and exemplify a manhood truly at odds with the racial patriarchy's false and empty maleness, both for themselves and other men of color. El Hajj Malik Shabazz demonstrated true black manhood need not rest on the brutalization and denigration of women. Quite the opposite. It needed to respect and support women in order to reach its fruition. He says about Ms. Hamer, "Now you see why Mississippi's in trouble. I hope that our brothers, especially our brothers here in Harlem, listen well, very closely to what I call one of the country's foremost freedom fighters. You don't have to be a man to fight for freedom. All you have to do is be an intelligent human being." Thank you.